Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD To The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are talking about the all-female chef lineup for the upcoming chocolate and coffee dinner at Milktooth in Indianapolis. We'll hear from the instigator of the dinner, Julie Bolajak of Chocolate for the Spirit, about why she saw a need for a dinner spotlighting women chefs. And we'll talk to the participants, Abby Maris, executive chef and partner at Bluebeard, Aaron Kim, executive chef at R Bistro, Zoe Taylor, pastry chef at Milktooth, and bartender Jessica Taylor, president of the local chapter of the United States Bartenders Guild. We'll hear about their dishes, the drinks, and their personal stories as well. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org.
Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
This week here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are focusing on one particular pop-up dinner, a chocolate and coffee dinner sponsored by Chocolate for the Spirit and Bee Coffee Roasters, but we're not focusing on it just because of the ingredients. We're also looking at this dinner and its participants because it's an all-woman lineup. Two executive chefs, a pastry chef, and one of the city's top bartenders. Is that significant? Does gender matter these days when it comes to cooking? For chocolatier Julie Bolajak of Chocolate for the Spirit, the instigator of this indie chef chicks dinner, the lack of female chefs in the local spotlight is a problem. For the chefs, well, not so much. They're focused on the food and drink. So we'll be talking with each participant about their dish for the dinner, which takes place October 26th at Milktooth in Indianapolis. But we'll also talk about their background, where the chefs and bartender are from, where they are now, what they do, and how they do it. But first, we have to talk about how the idea for this Indie Chef Chicks Chocolate and Coffee Dinner came about, with Julie Bolajak of Chocolate for the Spirit.
You know, it would be really great if I could just say that it simply was, I love chocolate and I love coffee. And as a woman business owner, I like to support women in business. And the marriage of all that is what was the impetus for the event. But as usual, there's a little more substance behind my story here.
So there's the backstory, right? What's the backstory?
The backstory is that I had 30 years in the corporate world, and I wouldn't have had those years had it not been for people who not only pushed open, but maybe in some instances blew open doors to give opportunities to people like myself. Now, during those 30 years, which I'm very, very grateful for, okay, but I did experience things like sexism, racism, ageism, and those things still do exist in our society across all industries, right? So I've always had in my mind some of the struggles that I've gone through and that I've seen others go through, and that if I had opportunities to help open some doors for people, that I would try to do that. I'm in this industry now, in the food industry in Indianapolis, and I am just so elated to see all the great evolution that's going on in this city, okay?
Sure, a lot of attention recently to some restaurants and chefs.
Absolutely, yes. You know, I remember when you couldn't even get a decent bagel in Indianapolis. So I'm just really thrilled. But as I'm an observer of all of this, I'm looking and I'm seeing it's guys. And I'm like, where are the women? And because I work so much with my business, quite frankly, I'm not really out there much. So at one point, I just sort of even thought, well, gee, are there women out there? So I asked people, and I found out there were. And I thought, you know, maybe this is an opportunity that I can help to open some doors, and we can put a spotlight on some of the great women in Indianapolis area who are doing what a lot of us do every day, which is show up to work and bang out stuff and do it as best as we can. So that's what happened. And of course, because I do love chocolate and I do love coffee, and BJ Davis is the founder of Bee Coffee Roasters, I thought, you know, I've seen these things on TV where they have like a secret ingredient or a special ingredient. And I have for years incorporated chocolate in savory dishes, not just desserts. So I'm like, you know, let's get a group of talented women together. Let's showcase them and let's have them feature as a special ingredient in each of their creations, either chocolate and or coffee. So that's what happened.
Well, it sounds like a great idea. So that's, you know, and that's why we're talking about it, because it is such a great idea. You know, chefs tell me, for example, you know, somebody will come in with a delivery and they'll ask to speak to the chef because they assume that the woman talking to them is not the chef. And that still happens even today. And I'm sure there are many more examples of that sort of thing.
Well, sure. I mean, sure there are. Like, you know, people want to maybe pretend like it doesn't exist, but it does. And we can't ever work and address any of our society's issues if we don't acknowledge that they're there. Okay. We can have a sense of humor about it. Okay. We're, you know, we don't have to be militant about things, but we also don't have to accept the status quo when we can do better.
You know, and so that we can acknowledge the elephant in the living room, as they say, and talk about it and point it out.
Exactly. So we're going to feed the elephant a little chocolate and and some coffee and put a big spotlight on it. How's that?
We've been talking with Julie Boljak of Chocolate for the Spirit. Tickets for the chocolate and coffee dinner featuring some of Indy's top culinary talent are $75. For tickets, look for Indy Chef Chicks at Eventbrite.com. Well, first on our chocolate and coffee dinner pop-up lineup is Aaron Kim, executive chef at Our Bistro, a Mass Ave restaurant known for its commitment to local ingredients and its weekly changing menu. Aaron tells us how she created her dish and how she turns a Swedish donut into a savory element that plays up pork cheeks.
My dish is a pork cheek dish with a Swedish donut that's savory, and I think that's how the whole dish got started. I'd made some Swedish donuts for a dessert, and they're actually made with mashed potato, which is kind of fun.
Kind of different.
Yeah, it's easy to make them more savory, so I just leave out some of the sugar, add a little espresso, and it's a great accompaniment to the pork cheeks. And then I'm doing a kind of a play on jelly donut with a lingonberry sauce that's a little bit jelly-like, and I'm adding some port to that to make it really savory.
Well, it sounds wonderful. How did those ideas come together?
Sometimes it's just an ingredient. Sometimes it's, you know, the idea of incorporating coffee and chocolate, a couple of ingredients together, and how that would work to incorporate both. So my pork cheek gravy has chocolate in it, and my donuts have coffee. So I'm using both components that are featured in this dinner for this one dish.
And both in a savory dish, too, which is very interesting. Is that challenging to do?
Anymore, I think there's a lot of crossover. Like, you know, one of my favorite ingredients is pomegranate molasses. It's sweet, but it's tart. And I use it way more often in savory dishes than I do for sweet dishes. So, and like the, you know, the concept of like a fruit sauce with a protein, I think is fantastic. And I traveled to Sweden a couple years ago, and, you know, lingonberries, cloudberries, things like that are often used with savory dishes. So I love that combination.
How does travel influence you? A lot, right?
Tremendously, yes. I have a great, my best friend, she and I travel together, and, you know, food is the highlight. Like, okay, we'll get our accommodations, but then where are we going to eat? And we're having lunch, already thinking about where we're going to have dinner. So, or, oh, that looks like a good place to come back for a snack, you know. So we eat our way around other countries. And then I always come back with, ooh, you know, remember that dish we had in Helsinki? And we'll kind of do my own take. I don't ask for the recipe at the restaurant, but I think I can do this.
We've been talking with Chef Aaron Kim of Our Bistro about the October 26th Indie Chef Chicks Dinner featuring chocolate and coffee. We'll be right back with more from Aaron here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio. On Eat Drink Indiana Radio today, we are focusing on the all-female chef lineup of the October 26th chocolate and coffee dinner at Milktooth in Indianapolis. Chef Aaron Kim of Our Bistro has been at the highly regarded Mass Ave restaurant for a dozen years, but she could have ended up in academia. Aaron tells us here how time spent teaching in France convinced her to go to culinary school.
I come from a family of teachers, so I thought after I decided I wasn't going to become a veterinarian or a ballerina, I figured, oh, I'll go into academia. A lot of teachers in my family. I went to Ball State, you know, known for their teachers' college, but got the opportunity to teach English in France for a year.
Ooh, what was that like?
That was fantastic. It, you know, I didn't make a lot of money, but I was in a great city where I lived in Nancy, where I could walk everywhere. I tried new foods. It's in the Alsace-Lorraine area of France, so it was totally different for me, having been in southern France before. More of, you know, Alsatian food was kind of new to me. And then I lived on the edge of the Arabic neighborhood as well.
Oh, now that's very cool.
Yeah, that maybe had something to do with my love of Middle Eastern food. Yeah, I'd say that was very influential. And then I did a lot of cooking on my own in France and dining at cool restaurants and trying things I hadn't had before and came home thinking, okay, I want to go to culinary school instead of grad school. So.
Oh, my goodness. Now, were you finishing up your undergrad about that time?
I had just finished in December and got the job in January to go to France. So, I knew I'd be taking a year off to make a decision. And I had some French professors, one in particular who really kind of wanted me to follow in his footsteps and go down to Chapel Hill for grad school and become a French professor. But, I didn't go that route in the end. But
was that interesting when you come back from teaching in France to come back and say, well, I'm gonna go to culinary school?
People didn't seem surprised though, especially my family. They weren't surprised at all. My brother did ask, do you think you, floundered your French degree. I said, oh my gosh, absolutely not. That is handy all the time. I already know how to spell croque en bouche, and I aced all the spelling tests in culinary school. So
where did you go to school, and how did you end up here?
I went to New England Culinary Institute in Vermont.
Why there?
I toured. I had gotten information online from various schools, and I my mom and I took a road trip, and I toured both campuses up there, and it seemed like a really great place to go to school. The program there, the student-teacher ratio was really small, all hands-on. You're not in a big class ever. And it was, 75% real-life cooking. You're cooking for people's wedding receptions. You're cooking for the cafeteria for all the students and instructors, the bake shop, all of that goes to the outlets that the school ran, all the restaurants. And so it was all real life experience. There's a lot of pressure, but
It sounds like it would be kind of a tough program.
It was. It was very intensive. Some classes were 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. But boy, did I learn a lot in a short amount of time from some really great instructors.
What did you have in mind to do? Did you have a specialty that you were going for or anything like that?
Not really. I think their program really makes you well-versed. I mean, you can have your preferences, but they didn't really encourage specialization. They wanted you to be well-rounded. So, and having two externships in the program helped as well.
Now, where did you go for those?
I did my first one here in Indy at a hotel, and I did my second one in Germany at another hotel out, kind of out in the country. It was a beautiful setting. I absorbed a lot of German that way.
So you have traveled a lot, it sounds like.
I have, yeah. I've, even before I decided I wanted to do this, I had some great travel opportunities. When I was at Ball State, I went to France for a semester. I went to Vietnam, which is another one of my favorite cuisines.
Some French influence there, too.
Definitely, definitely. I got to speak French in Vietnam as well. Yeah. But then, yeah, all of my travels, you know, we shut down the restaurant for about 8 days in July, and everyone takes a vacation at the same time. And so that's a highlight of my years. Where am I going on vacation? So,
again, around food, right?
Around food, yep. If it's a food desert, I'm not going there on vacation. There might be some interesting sights to see, but it has to have good food.
Now, how did you end up here in Indianapolis at Our Bistro?
I'm from Muncie, but I knew I didn't want to go work at a restaurant in Muncie, and this seemed like the next best thing. And a chef that I worked for in Muncie for a time before culinary school, she had opened a restaurant in Zionsville called The Pidge. And so my thought was to come work with her, and ended up working at Tavola de Tosa with Tony Hanslitz.
Well, now, that was a good place to come, right?
That was a great place, yes. Wonderful food and kind of a one-of-a-kind restaurant in Indy.
Oh, I think everybody misses it. So what was that like? You know, was it difficult starting out?
There were times, yeah. And I was the only female in his kitchen most of the time I was there. And, you know, felt a little bit, not bullied, but a little bit, you know, treated differently by everybody because I was the only female. So I think that gave me a tougher skin for future endeavors.
Now, how did you end up here then?
Tavola de Tosa closed, unfortunately, and Tony said, "Erin, Monday you need to go talk to Regina at Our Bistro." And as it turned out, her sous chef had just given his 2-week notice to go elsewhere, and so she practically hired me on the spot. She said she was going to think about it for a week because it was a busy week, but she called me 2 days later and offered me the job. So very thankful for that.
Now, what's it been like at Our Bistro?
It's been such a pleasure working here, and I joke about it feeling like a new restaurant every week since we changed the menu every week. And I think a lot of people don't realize how challenging that can be. So it's a challenge, but it's fun. It's good to challenge yourself, and there's something new every week that I've never made before.
We've been talking with Chef Erin Kim, executive chef at Our Bistro in Indianapolis, and one of the chefs participating in the upcoming Chocolate and Coffee Dinner October 26th at Milktooth. For tickets to the event, look for Indie Chef Chicks at eventbrite.com. We are focusing here today on an upcoming pop-up dinner and the question, how do you create a dish featuring chocolate and coffee? I put that question to local chef Abby Maris, executive chef and partner at Bluebeard in Indianapolis. She tells us how her duck carpaccio dish developed and where her inspiration for any new dish comes from.
I believe I'm curing a duck breast with star anise and mocha, so a mixture of chocolate and coffee. And then after I cure that, I'll roast it and slice it and make it a carpaccio. And then I'm going to serve that with warm pickled maitake mushrooms, purple daikon, charred scallions, and I can't remember the last ingredient. I'm sorry, I don't have my notes right in front of me.
So when you go to come up with a dish like that, like something that, you know, has specific ingredients, where do you start?
Well, in my situation, we started with the chocolate and the coffee, obviously. And then everyone had, you know, their courses picked out. So knowing that I was third course, I didn't want to go too heavy, but I didn't want to go too light. And I figured doing something like a originally I wanted to do seafood, but then I was having a hard time trying to figure out something that would work, and I didn't want to do something too similar to like a Spanish or Mexican themed dish, because I thought maybe Aaron might have gone in that direction. I wasn't quite sure. So I went ahead and went with Asian, and I figured duck, carpaccio, would still be light, and then I could make it a little bit heavier by sautéing some mushrooms and just bulking up the dish a little bit.
How do you incorporate, you know, something like chocolate or coffee into a dish? Is that a challenge, or is that just another ingredient?
I don't think it's a challenge necessarily. I mean, I have a background in pastry, so, trying to use both of those in one dish is not a challenge, but when you're doing it in a savory application, it could be slightly. But, you know, tons of people do it. There's soups and all kinds of different dishes. So I don't think it's a challenge necessarily, but I can see where some people would think it would be.
Is creating a savory dish different from creating a sweet dish?
No, not at all. I mean, in my mind, it's still whatever I want. And then, well, when you're creating a pastry or a sweet, you know, you got to keep in mind all of the technicalities of the baking process. I feel like with savory, you can kind of be a little bit more free and loosey-goosey with it.
Do the individual pieces fit together well in these kinds of dinners?
It's funny you say that, because sometimes it does and sometimes it does not. But then you kind of have to go into it knowing that it's going to be like either one of those ways. Some dinners that have been more thought out and planned, there are times when the chefs will all meet up together and kind of coordinate, especially if there's wine pairings or beer pairings with it, which those are kind of more cohesive. But if something's thrown together pretty last minute, or if people are just thrown together and like, hey, you're going to take second course, sometimes it doesn't all work together, but it's more about having fun and being together and working with all these different chefs.
We've been talking chocolate and coffee with Chef Abby Maris, executive chef and partner at Bluebeard in Indianapolis, and a participant in the upcoming Indie Chef Chicks dinner on October 26th at Milktooth. We'll be right back with more from Abby here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio. Ten years ago, local chef Abby Maris thought she'd switch from the back of the house to the front of the house and become a server instead of a cook. But that didn't happen, and the talented chef instead worked for local chef Greg Hardesty, went to culinary school, studied pastry, and began to make her mark in Indianapolis. In fact, Bluebeard, which she opened as an executive chef and partner, was a James Beard Award semifinalist for Best New Restaurant in 2013. Abby fills us in on how it all happened.
When I was 18, I moved to Norfolk, Virginia, and I got a job just at this little carry-out restaurant, and I was just a counter girl. But anyone that worked there has to do a little prep in the kitchen on their downtime. So eventually, just by doing that, I worked my way up and became the manager. And then I was like, oh, I think I'm actually pretty good at this. So I decided I was going to go to another restaurant and kind of just start building up, you know.
In the kitchen?
In the kitchen, yeah. So then I worked at another place in Norfolk, and then I figured it was time for me to move back to Indianapolis. So in 2005, I moved here. And I wasn't going to continue on with cooking anymore.
Well, what were you going
to
do?
I thought I would try to make more money and become a server. But Greg Hardesty was bound and determined to not let me do that. And so he gave me a job, or made a position for me, in this kitchen at Elements. So I was at Elements for 3 years. Went to the Chef's Academy for pastries with the scholarship, and then went out to New York for an internship for a few months.
Now tell me about that internship.
The internship was amazing. So it was 3 months long. I stayed in Manhattan. I worked at a place called Pong, which is now closed, Pacheong, a great sweet and savory pastry chef. And then I also had another job at this modern Italian restaurant called Falai, which was, again, owned by a pastry chef. But it was, a lot of, like, molecular gastronomy and, you know, chemicals and whatnot. So that was a really great experience. You know, I was just busy all the time working. I mean, if you live in New York, I feel like that's all you should probably be doing, because it's way too expensive to do anything else.
Was that cool? So you weren't very old then, right? And so there you are in New York?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I like to travel, and, you know, being by myself is not hard when you're surrounded by, you know, millions of other people. And like-minded people, too, in the restaurant industry.
Right.
Yeah, it was a blast. I learned a lot, and learned a lot about myself, too, in that short amount of time.
That was Elements culinary school internship. Then what?
And then I came back and I worked briefly with Regina at our bistro. And then I also did a short stint at the Chef's Academy being an assistant instructor. And then I went to Recess when Greg was opening that. So I was at Recess for about 2.5 years. And during that time, towards the end of it, Ed Batista approached John Adams and myself about, you know, doing this restaurant.
Now, what was that like to think about your own place?
It was very exciting, but also very, I was very nervous about it. Because, you know, I've always been a sous chef or, you know, a line cook for so long. And then this restaurant just kind of fell in our lap. And, we were pretty gung-ho, but I was very nervous. But once it all started happening, it seemed very natural. And now here we are, 3 years later. It's been pretty successful.
Well, now, talk a little bit about what happened along the way, because you guys came out with a bang and got lots of national attention right away. What was that like?
That was very surprising. We were not expecting that to happen. But, from the very beginning, you know, as soon as the doors opened up, people were flooding in, and we were not prepared for it. The kitchen was not designed properly. Like, we had to get more equipment. We had to hire more people. And it was hilarious because even with the Cultural Trail being dug up, you know, parking was a huge issue. People were just, like, crawling over, like, piles of dirt. It was bizarre.
It was. I mean, really, it was torn up in front of the restaurant. They were, you know, like plywood to try to step over the stuff. And yet people kept coming.
Yeah. Yep, and now it's finally beautiful and fixed, and they still keep coming, thank God.
Now, what were you going for when you created this? Because, you know, you were involved from the very start, you know, as you said, you know, from the very thought that, well, maybe you're going to have a restaurant.
Well, the initial idea was to have, an ever-changing menu, showcasing a lot of bread, obviously, because Amelia's our bakery, but also staying true to, like, true Italian food. Being that we're in an Italian neighborhood, the Batistas are Italian, the bread's Italian. But then that simply faded because I was like, I want to do a burger today. You know, I kind of want to eat tacos. I want to eat pho. So that kind of got away from us. And then now we're just, contemporary American. And I think it's fine. Yeah. You know, the food's great. We still have pastas.
Have you seen some changes as you've gone along with customers? You know, do you feel like, you know, maybe are they more adventuresome now than they were, you know, some years ago?
Oh, yes, for sure. I think with the popularity of the chef stardom has and the television, you know, there's so many TV shows that promote the culinary scene. And I think people are definitely more ambitious, and there's many places that you can be ambitious at now in Indy. Before, I don't think there was that many places. We're not just a steakhouse city anymore.
Talk a little bit about the culinary scene, you know, that as you've seen it evolve over the last few years.
Well, I guess when I arrived in the city in 2005, you know, there was a handful of places that whenever I was off, you know, I could attend or go and eat some of the food, but nothing really is like stuck out in my mind. But now, you know, you look down Virginia Avenue and there's, you know, Pioneer, there's Milk Tooth, even the old bars around here, like the Dugout, they're like rehabbing their entire menu and trying to like be with the times now. So yeah, I mean, it's blossomed tremendously.
We've been talking with Abby Maris, executive chef and partner at Blue Beard in Indianapolis. She'll be creating a course at the upcoming Chocolate and Coffee Dinner October 26th. For tickets, go to eventbrite.com. So what's for dessert on a chocolate and coffee dinner menu? Pastry chef Zoe Taylor of Milk Tooth, whose work has been recently featured in Bon Appetit magazine, tells us about her dish, which includes a croissant, poached pears, and white chocolate ice cream.
So my dish is a barley malt croissant dough that I'll shape into a shell. And then I'm going to be doing a caramelized white chocolate ice cream that'll sit inside of it with some hibiscus and cascara poached pears. And the cascara is my coffee element.
Well, now tell me what that is, because that's kind of unusual. People probably don't know what that is.
So cascara is the husk of the coffee cherry, and it's just peeled away, and usually, a lot of people use it in teas and tea seins, and it's dried, and it has kind of like this very fruity and almost tobacco-y flavor to it. So I'm going to use that to poach the pears in along with some hibiscus. It'll give it some color. It pairs really well with fruit, and the caramelized white chocolate will be perfect with it too, because it has that kind of nutty flavor with it.
Now tell me about the white chocolate.
I'm not a huge fan of white chocolate. I don't quite understand it. It seems like it's like decaf coffee where it shouldn't exist. All the flavor has been zapped out of it. But something really beautiful and magical happens to it when you put it in a very low oven, and it kind of turns this just like caramel brown and takes on a bunch of really roasty, delicious flavors. So I'm gonna caramelize it and then kind of incorporate it into just like a velvety ice cream and let that flavor shine through.
Well, now you make it sound wonderful. So that sounds great. Now tell me what the pears will look like, because it sounds like they're going to get some color, right?
Yep, they're going to get some color for sure. They're just going to be whole poached in some hibiscus and then with the cascara also. But the hibiscus will lend a very pink hue to the pears. It'll dye them pretty much magenta. So well, add some color to it.
It sounds beautiful. So it sounds like it's going to be a beautiful and creamy, ice creamy, pastry wonderfulness, right?
It's a whole amalgamation of things going on. But I really just wanted to highlight the cascara, which has these beautiful fruity kind of roasty notes. And using the barley malt, which is like more of a savory flavor, will help bring out, you know, the tobacco notes in the cascara, and the fruitiness of the hibiscus will help lend itself to the fruitiness of the cascara too.
Now, for the dinner, for the chocolate and coffee dinner that's coming up, that will be held at Milk Tooth. How do you think that's going to work? You have these two other chefs coming in. You've got another bartender coming in. Is that going to be kind of challenging?
I don't think so. I'm excited. I've seen so many special events happen at Milk Tooth, and it's such an easy, like, open, collaborative space that I think I can't wait to see a bunch of girls behind that line. To be honest, there's just boys back there all the time. So to get Abby and Aaron back there will be just so much fun.
We've been talking dessert with pastry chef Zoe Taylor of Milk Tooth, who is creating her dessert course for the October 26th chocolate and coffee dinner at Milk Tooth. We'll be right back with more from Zoe on Eat Drink Indiana Radio. Well, it's been a heck of a year for Milk Tooth pastry chef Zoe Taylor. Not only was chef owner Jonathan Brooks one of Food & Wine magazine's best new chefs of 2015, but Bon Appetit named Milk Tooth one of the country's hot new restaurants and featured Zoe's pastries as well. What's it been like? Zoe gives us a scoop on where she thought she'd be and how things actually turned out.
I went to undergrad for English literature and French, and I had fully intended on becoming an English or French professor one day. So, you know, that was kind of in the works. But as I was going to undergrad, I worked at a small family-run coffee shop called Kavarna in Green Bay, which is where I went to school. And they, kind of had just been buying the same old weird Cisco bought baked goods for a while, and I was hoping on, you know, doing something better, something different. And so kind of just started baking there and earned my chops and just fell in love with it and finished school and didn't really foresee it going much further than that. But when I moved to Indy, I applied to work at Bluebeard as the assistant pastry chef and under Abby Maris, and got the position somehow.
Now that was based on your
on your pastry shop working in Green Bay, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, not that an English degree isn't great, but
right.
You know, you got it on the strength of your pastry skills, I suppose.
Yes, the strength of the pastry skills and the strength of the English degree helping my resume writing for sure. But I worked under Abby for about 8 months and loved it. Learned so much from her. She's such a strong, inspirational figure. Especially just turning Bluebeard into like one of the most successful restaurants Indianapolis has ever seen has been great.
So where'd it go from there?
From there, a spot opened up in Amelia's, and I had just from working in the kitchen at Bluebeard, I had kind of come in close contact with Charlie McIntosh, the head baker over there, and was really curious about whether I could earn my chops at playing around with bread, because it's something that I mean, if I were to be stranded on a desert island tomorrow, I want like a loaf of bread and that's it. So I wanted to learn the secrets of it. And, I went to work over there for about 8 months and kind of helped Charlie develop a fledgling pastry program for Amelia's, just like for farmers markets, scones and different things and brownies and stuff. So we got to play around and, figure out what worked, you know, for Amelia's, which was a lot of fun. But yeah, mostly just learned the ins and outs of sourdough bread, which was what I really wanted to do.
From Amelia's, is that's how you ended up at Milktooth, yes?
Yeah. Yeah. So, just kind of working and, creating, I think, a pastry program for Amelia's was probably, well, I'm not even really sure what caught John's eye, but, we had, known each other through, Grace, who was my coworker at Amelia's, it's Ashley's sister. So, you know, we had known of each other, and he kind of talked to me a little bit about, you know, fledgling Milktooth and some ideas he had, you know, how he wanted to make bialy for it. And I was like, well, I can make bialy. I used to make, you know, bagels all the time, and, you know, just said that offhand. And I don't know, maybe it stuck in his head. And he was, once he came around to wanting to find a pastry chef, I was probably one of the first people he thought of, hopefully, I don't know. But, yeah, so he kind of talked to me, wanted to interview me for it, and we sat down one day and hashed it out, and he hired me, so.
Now, you have to talk a little bit about this year, because this has been a heck of a year at Milktooth, and for you, for John, for the whole team. So tell me a little bit about what that's been like.
It's just been fast-paced and nonstop, but I feel like if we had an opportunity to like stop and take a breath, I don't know if we would have like been able to keep going. Like just the fact that we've like maintained momentum this whole time, I think is what really keeps us afloat. It's fun. It's just been so challenging, but exciting. And I don't know. Maybe at one point we're going to have a chance to stop and catch our breath, but I kind of hope not, because it feels like we're constantly on that like downward slope of the roller coaster, and I never want it to end. It's a lot of fun. So
Milktooth launched a year ago, mm-hmm. last October. You know, you were kind of busy from the opening gate, right?
Yeah.
And then it just sort of built from there.
Yeah. In the beginning, it was just me making all the batters and then everything for the pastries. And like I said, I have an assistant now that helps me out, but which I was drowning at one point. And so to have Emily to help me out is amazing. But in the beginning, like for instance, I would make one batch of pancake batter that would last us like half a week. And that batch of pancake batter had like probably 16 eggs in it. And now we make pancake batter almost every day. And our batch now has 96 eggs in it. And we make that every single day.
So what was it like when Bon Appetit called?
That has not stopped being very surreal for me. It was totally unexpected when they announced that the Honeyway cake was made and made it into the top 10 best new desserts. I just remember, you know, I got home from work. It was a weekend. I was like completely exhausted. And John calls me and he's like, the Honeyway cake is one of the top 10 best desserts in the country. And I was like, oh, that's really funny. You know, like great. Because the Honeyway cake originated as a way for us to get rid of whey, which we had as a byproduct of making our own ricotta in-house. So we just, like, had all of this whey, you know, which is just the liquid from the cheese-making process. And I was like, well, how can I use this, you know, in something? And I figured out, you know, like, using it almost like as a buttermilk substitute in cakes is just adds a really nice, rich dairy flavor without, you know, being too overpowering. And so I started using that. And then just the fact that that turned into one of the best, you know, new desserts in the country just flabbergasted me. So exciting, but crazy, crazy, unexpected.
So what does that have? That has ramifications, you know, so it's a big deal. How does that feel?
It feels great. It feels, I mean, just, you know that you guys kind of know my background, know that I'm, you know, self-taught. It feels very validating, and amazing to know that, you know, this kind of career that I've seemed to have fallen into is something that I can do and be really, really good at. And, that excites me. I just want to keep getting better.
We've been talking with Milktooth pastry chef Zoe Taylor, who is handling dessert at the upcoming Indie Chef Chicks Chocolate and Coffee Dinner. Tickets are $75 and are available at eventbrite.com. Well, you can't have a chocolate and coffee dinner without drinks. And local bartender Jessica Taylor, president of the local chapter of the U.S. Bartenders Guild, tells us what guests will be drinking at the October 26th chocolate and coffee dinner at Milktooth.
I'm doing two different cocktails. My first cocktail is called Hop To It, and the base spirit for that cocktail is going to be Jameson Caskmates, which I am going to infuse with cocoa nibs. And then...
That sounds good already.
I'm also going to do some Sandamon Amontillado Sherry. So that'll bring a little bit of nuttiness to it. And then I'm going to take a cold brew coffee from B Coffee Roasters and infuse it with hops. So I'll add a little bit of citrus and a little bit of bitterness to it. And then I'll use a little bit of Espresso Demerara just to sweeten it up. And then I'm using two different kinds of bitters. I'm going to use some double barrel-aged bitters and chocolate bitters.
So that sounds terrific. So what's the other one?
So for the other cocktail, I'm going to do a drink called Wake Up Manhattan. This is just a riff on a classic Manhattan. I'm going to use Oak by Absolute, which is a barrel-rested vodka, with some coffee-infused Carpino Antica.
What's that?
Carpino is a sweet vermouth. So I'm going to infuse that with whole coffee beans from B. And the method for infusing that I'm using on that is an ISI charger. So I'm going to rapid infuse it, put it in the ISI charger, run a cartridge through it. And then what happens is when you release the pressure on it, it creates a vacuum. And so the flavor from the coffee infuses into the vermouth.
Oh, sort of sous vide-ish, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I got it.
And then I'm also going to do Bitterman's Mole Bitters in there. And then we're going to do an allspice dram rinse. So the allspice dram will be, again, just kind of hitting on those baking spices that we're going to pull from the mole bitters.
Oh, my goodness. Now, so those, to me, those sound very complicated and a lot of thought into that, you know, to figure out what ingredients go well with coffee or the spirits. How do you start to do that? How do you start to develop a drink like that?
Well, usually the first thing I do is go to my favorite book of all time, The Flavor Bible. And when I start to build a cocktail, I generally have a classic cocktail in mind as far as the build. So like a Manhattan, for example, the classic build is 2-1-2. It's 2 ounces of base spirit, 1 ounce of vermouth, and 2 dashes of bitters. So I don't necessarily keep the exact same build every time, but I always start with that build for a cocktail. And then I just start thinking about flavors.
You know, it sounds very much like a dish, like a chef building a dish, you know, with all these different flavors.
A lot of times I will kind of take notes or take a cue from a chef or a chef's dish as to their flavors. You know, I may not be using the exact same ingredients they're using, but I know that, you know, a particular ingredient may have these characteristics, and I can take, you know, whatever those flavors or characteristics are and translate them into a cocktail.
How much difference does something like just a little bit of bitters make in a drink?
Bitters make a huge difference in a drink, and bartenders across the entire world will actually refer to bitters as the salt and pepper of the bartending world. So, you know, think of your spice cabinet. That's how we treat bitters. We have this array of all these different brands of bitters now, and these are by way of drops or dashes. These are ways that we can enhance the flavor of a cocktail without adding volume to the cocktail.
We've been talking with bartender Jessica Taylor about the drinks she's created for the Indie Chef Chicks Chocolate and Coffee Dinner. We'll be back with more from Jessica here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio. Bartender Jessica Taylor, the current president of the Indianapolis chapter of the United States Bartenders Guild, tells us what she's up to, from introducing a new product to the market as a brand ambassador and account specialist, to raising the profile of the Indianapolis cocktail community.
I recently just took a job with Absolut, so I am now a brand ambassador. More specifically, I'm an account specialist for Oak by Absolut.
So what does that mean? What do you do?
With every brand, it means something a little bit different. For me, I'm launching a brand new product to the market, so it has, during the day, it's a lot of me just visiting accounts, which luckily is a lot of my friends, and giving them samples and talking about the product and what our drink strategy is and what our target demographic is for this product, and basically selling into accounts. So working a lot like a sales consultant or a sales rep for a distributor would do. And the fun part is then after I get all that hard work done, then essentially the brand ambassador part of my job comes in, where I have events and I get to hang out in bars and I get to buy drinks for people. And for some reason, they pay me to do it, which is pretty fantastic.
So that sounds like a fun gig. Now, you have a very extensive bartending background, though. So tell me a little bit about that, too.
I do. I bartended for nearly 9 years for a microbrewery called Alcatraz, which is no longer in existence. But I had a great experience with them. And then I spent the next 4.5 years as the lead bartender with JW Marriott. It was a fantastic opportunity. It gave me the chance to learn something new because I had never worked in a hotel before. So that was something really, really important that, you know, kind of helped round out my resume a little bit. And I will actually be joining the team at Merrow in Fountain Square when they open up.
Oh, no, that's fun. So what kind of cocktail program can we expect there?
Steve Simon is actually running the cocktail program there. He's kind of an up-and-coming bartender, and I'm really, really excited to work with him. Definitely, I would expect to see a lot of acids there. He's playing with citric acid. I know he's playing with malic acid. And he'll still, of course, use fresh citrus there, but I know he's playing around a lot with that. I know he's talked about a lot of clarification, so doing, you know, like maybe a clarified milk punch or clarifying lemon juice.
Now tell me what that means.
There are a few different methods for doing it, but essentially it means it's pulling the proteins out of whatever the liquid is, so that you have a clear product.
Like clarified butter.
Exactly.
Okay, I get it now. Now, you are very active in the USBG, which is the local chapter of the United States Bartenders Guild. In fact, you are the president of the organization. So tell me about that as well.
So the USBG, we have a chapter in Indianapolis. We have right around 100 members, and I am the current president for our chapter. Our terms are 2 years, so I'm about halfway in right now. Our chapter itself is about 3 years old. We're still a fairly young chapter, but we are a very fast-growing chapter and a pretty big presence, for sure, in the Midwest and lately across the entire country. We get a lot of mentions nationally, so we're pretty proud of that.
Now, that's probably because you participate in a lot of things. So tell me some of the events that you make a point of going to around the country.
As you know, there are cocktail weeks and events and competitions nearly every single day of the year. And it's so hard to choose what you're going to go to, especially as a group, you know, and what you can budget for and what you can make time for. But we pick some of the big ones. So we thoroughly enjoy going to Tales of the Cocktail, which is in New Orleans every July.
Now, that's a big one, right?
Oh, it's huge. I think the number this year I heard was somewhere in the vicinity of 30,000 bartenders. Yeah, it's insane. But it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of education behind it as well. So you go to class all day, and then you go to brand-sponsored events at night and enjoy cocktails made from bartenders across the world.
Some other, you know, like events that you like to participate in.
Yeah, we have a pretty important one coming up that I'll actually be leaving for on Saturday. It's Portland Cocktail Week, and this is, I believe, the sixth year for Portland Cocktail Week. It is very heavy on the education focus. I think we've got about 7 or 8 people from Indiana going this year.
Now, you've mentioned before when we've talked about, you know, going to different places around the country and seeing interesting things that they're doing. As far as, you know, the beverage industry goes that we might not have here. I think, you know, maybe I tend to think that everything is happening everywhere, but that's probably not the case, right?
Yeah, I think eventually it all happens everywhere. We used to say that Indianapolis was about 5 years behind what everyone else was doing, or on either coast at least. I don't think that we're anywhere near that far away from what the coast cities are doing or what the larger markets are doing. I think it's a lot safer bet to say that we're maybe a year, maybe, if that far behind.
Is it a good time to be in the industry, do you think?
I think it's a fantastic time to be in the industry. I'm so excited, but a little bit jealous of the people who are just entering our industry because they have so many things available to them right now. You know, the tools and, you know, the trips and just the opportunities that didn't exist or were very hard to find when I first started bartending. But I'm excited because I look at how many years I've been doing this. You know, I've been bartending for 12 years now, and I can only imagine what these brand new bartenders who are, you know, just a year in, what they're going to be doing in 12 years. I mean, it's going to be amazing.
We've been talking with bartender Jessica Taylor of the USBG, an account specialist for Oak by Absolute and bartender at the soon-to-open Marrow restaurant in Fountain Square. She's also creating drinks for the upcoming chocolate and coffee dinner at Milktooth. For information and tickets, check eventbrite.com.
You've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. Thanks so much for tuning in this week for our chocolate and coffee dinner themed show. And thanks also to our guests, Julie Boljak of Chocolate for the Spirit, Chef Aaron Kem of R Bistro, Chef Abby Maris of Bluebeard, Pastry Chef Zoe Taylor of Milktooth, and bartender Jessica Taylor of the United States Bartenders Guild, as well as Marrow and Oak by Absolute. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio.